This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Today's show was pre-recorded, so we can't take your calls this afternoon. Between 1882 and 1968, the NAACP documented 4,743 lynchings in the United States. All were abhorrent, but none was more socially and politically impactful than the lynching of Emmett Till. Born in Chicago to parents who had moved north from the Mississippi Delta as part of the Great Migration, Till was 14 in 1955. That summer, Emmett accompanied his uncle on a trip to visit his extended family in Money, Tennessee. An encounter in a store one evening quickly spun out of control, stirring the local self-appointed protectors of white supremacy to seize Till in the middle of the night, lynch him, and throw his body in the local river. Emmett's grief-stricken mother, though horrified at the condition of her son's body, insisted on a coffin that allowed mourners to see what racism did to her child. The murder of Emmett Till, the events around his funeral, and the legacy it created are explored by Loyola University historian Elliot Gorn in his new book, Let the People See, The Story of Emmett Till. We interviewed Gorn when he spoke at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in November. Elliot Gorn, author of Let the People See, welcome to Cincinnati Edition. It's really good to have you back in Cincinnati and here today for this new book.
Thanks. It's very good to be here.
So, a great deal has been written about the Emmett Till murder and trial since it occurred in 1955. Why did you want to tackle this subject again? What was it that you thought you could get at that maybe hadn't been clarified, explored before?
The honest answer is I had no idea. The honest answer is that actually there's been a lot of writing on the Emmett Till story, but a lot of it is really very recent, remarkably recent. Before, when I started, which is about 8 years ago, there was one academic book. There were some other works. There wasn't that much. There was a lot of good video, increasingly good video, journalism that had been since 1955 all over the place. But I thought that the story deserved a telling, a book-length, full telling, and that's really what I wanted to do. As it turns out, there have been a couple of other books that came out right around, a little before mine. But I think we're all actually quite different from each other, and I think that I think we all had that same goal.
What sets yours apart in your mind? What is it that you were trying to get at?
Well, I think there's a few things. I think I spend more time on the trial in Sumner than the others. A little fuller description and analysis of what happened in Sumner, which is really where the story explodes into not just national but international headlines as news. I think I spend a little more time, really a lot more time, on memory, on how we have how since 1955 we've remembered the story, forgotten the story, how it's changed over time. Just to give one little example of that, if you do a search for Emmett Till in the New York Times, you get about 600 hits. The name Emmett Till has come up in 600 articles in the New York Times. A third of those are in the last 5 years. So the story is still very much with us, and we're in some ways telling the story more than at any time since 1955.
So your point is that in the act of remembering, which is what historians do on one level, what you come and realize is that cultures also, in the act of remembering, actively forget. And to some extent, this story was actively forgotten.
I think that's right, Dan. I think we like to think today, and it's repeated over and over again, that there was the Till story. People saw the photograph, the terrible photograph of Emmett Till in his coffin where he'd been just unmercifully beaten, this 14-year-old boy.
Which is the source of the title here, Let the People See, which is what his mother said when she saw the body, and when it came time for the funeral, they put a glass window on the top of the coffin.
She made that decision. And she also made the decision to allow a photographer to photograph her son. In this, she didn't let the mortician prettify him, and she let the photograph be taken. And that photograph was reprinted in Jet magazine, in the Chicago Defender, and other African American newspapers. Everyone just believes that that photograph was distributed everywhere, that everyone saw it. That's actually not true. It was seen in the African American press. It was passed around by black people in America. It actually did not enter the white mainstream media, not at all. Most people, white people, did not see that picture until 1987, until Eyes on the Prize. There were a few other little places where it showed up in video before that, but really it was that 1987 public TV national broadcast of Eyes on the Prize, which really begins with the Emmett Till story as the beginning of the civil rights movement, that sets the story, that makes us re-remember it now as the beginning of that, those struggles.
So when you say the mainstream press, the New York Times, the Washington Post,
Look Magazine, Life Magazine,
covered the murder and the trial, which, by the way, took place within a month after this. Very, very unusual from today's standards.
Yes, they covered it extensively, but they did not reproduce that photograph. So in the last couple of years, in The New Yorker, in Time magazine, it's repeated, again on CNN, it's repeated that the photograph was reprinted and that begins the civil rights movement, as if not just African-Americans, who called themselves, many of them, the Emmett Till generation, but that white people saw that, many white people saw that, the scales fell from their eyes, they knew suddenly the cruelty of Jim Crow segregation in the South, and they were, at least in their minds, in the movement. Well, they didn't see that photograph. It was not reprinted in those media. Those writing that in Time and The New Yorker and on CNN are wrong.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that the coffin is now at the National Museum, the new African-American Museum, mm-hmm. part of the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., where I was there this spring. And now you've got the coffin as an artifact. You've got the photos on display. And if you don't know much about the story, you can assume that, oh, gee, this has been in the public domain since 1955. And what you're saying is, really, there's at least a 30-year break before it became.
There's a 30-year break. And in that 30-year break, again, doing a little bit of database searching, the name Emmett Till almost disappears, at least to the extent that you can measure memory by whether the name shows up in newspaper articles, that sort of thing. The name almost disappears. And yes, it's so powerful at the new museum. It's a magnificent display. People come out of the museum, many of them, most of them maybe, say that that's the most powerful thing they saw. They use the word sacred. Oprah Winfrey used the word profound when she walked out of seeing that. And it's not just the coffin, it's the way they did it. And the staff apparently spent a lot of time talking about this, how they would, should they display it, and if they did, how. And what they basically did was to replicate the scene of the funeral in the Church of God in Christ on State Street in Chicago, with photo murals behind the coffin of the scene of the funeral itself, of the chorus of people.
Huge crowds.
100,000, at least 100,000 people on the south side of Chicago. They didn't know Emmett Till, but they came to see him, to his funeral.
So what is the relationship of Emmett Till's murder and then the trial that follows? And we'll come back and talk about those specific things. But what is the relationship between those two things and the civil rights movement, which this is 1955. So this is right after Brown versus Board of Education. This is just before you begin to get mass demonstrations that the entire country is focused on in the opposition to Jim Crow segregation. So what is the relationship if it's not automatic?
It's a very important relationship between, the civil rights movement and the Till murder. Brown versus the Board of Education is a year before the murder. And the Brown decision throws the entire South and much of the North just into turmoil. The idea that black children would be sitting next to white children in schools, that black males, adolescent males, would be sitting next to white adolescent females really upset people. This went right to the heart of what segregation was designed to do, to keep people from each other in relationships that could become intimate. That was the fear. So when the Till murder happens, it happens in the context of the South just being in turmoil, the beginnings of the citizens' councils to resist segregation, increased violence, new lynchings. It's part of a long history of lynching, but it is also part of a moment of this tremendous turmoil that begins in the South. The Till murder is also murder in trial. It's also just 4 months before the Montgomery bus boycott. In some ways, this signal moment of African-American organizing refusing to use, in the city of Montgomery, in the heart of Dixie, refusing to use the bus system. When Rosa Parks refuses to give up her seat on that bus, one of the things she says years later, when she's asked what was she thinking about, one of the things she tells people is, I was thinking about Emmett Till. She had literally, just a couple of nights before, gone to a lecture at her church about the Till murder and its aftermath. So the Till murder is just so important to all of that. It really is central among African Americans. The civil rights movement, we have to recognize and understand, is first and foremost a movement of and by African Americans, including in the South. And this is a moment for them that just generates horror, but at the same time, determination. All of the memoirs, John Lewis, Muhammad Ali, Ann Moody, they talk about how important this moment was to them.
Let's go back and talk about a couple of things. The murder itself, Emmett Till, 14 years old, lived in Chicago, came back to Mississippi to visit an uncle at the end of the summer before school started. And what happens? What's the flashpoint that triggers the ultimate murder, which then we'll get to the trial because the connections are not clear either between the murder and the trial.
I want to correct you on one thing when you say that Emmett Till is from Chicago. It's a little more complicated than that. He actually is from a town called Argo, Illinois, just outside Chicago. But in Argo, a little industrial town still in Cook County, the schools were integrated, sports teams were integrated. And I don't mean it was a tremendous, perfect, harmonious place. It's a little different than the South Side of Chicago, which is just rigidly segregated in this era. And that maybe makes you think a little bit about what this kid thought when he got south in Mississippi, how absurd the system of segregation must have seemed to him. He'd been told. He knew what to expect. But telling and really understanding is another thing.
Especially when you're 14 years old.
Especially when you're 14, just turned 14 years old. He came down to visit his great uncle, Mose Wright, a sharecropper and preacher, very, very respected man in his community. He wanted to be with his cousins, whom he was close to. This is part of the Great Migration. His family had come to the North, but families went back and forth from Mississippi to Chicago all the time, visiting each other. So there was nothing unusual in his going down there. He's a high energy kid. He's not a bad kid by any report. But he does go with his friends to this little grocery store, Crossroads store in Money, Mississippi. And he goes into the store and he buys some bubble gum and comes out. Whatever happens in that store exactly, we don't know precisely. His cousins.
But seemingly it took place within about a minute's time.
His cousins who were there just outside could detect nothing that went on. One of his cousins, his younger cousin, Simeon Wright, went in to bring him out, go in and bring him out. And he detected nothing was wrong. Now, right after that, the woman who was alone running the store, Carolyn Bryant, came out. And then Emmett Till whistled at her, a wolf whistle. Simeon Wright and Wheeler Parker, Emmett's two cousins who were there, both attest to this. They both insist, yes, it was a wolf whistle. There are other stories that he was just whistling to try to get to begin speaking as he had a stutter. And his cousins say, no, it was a wolf whistle, but they detected nothing else. Well, this gets worked up into a charge of assault of virtual rape, and then subsequently the trial of the men who come, kidnap him, beat him, and murder him.
Well, when you get to the trial, you have the sentence. You describe this on trial too. Besides the two people who are accused of murdering Emmett Till, on trial too was how Americans thought about race, and more explosively, how they thought about race and sex. There's much more going on here than just Emmett Till and two white farmers.
Absolutely. This is a trial really about the heart of American ideas about race and racism, and what is permissible and what isn't. That's why there was so much attention. It's not simply a 14-year-old boy and those who murdered him. This really was about how America, at a really reaching a turning point, is thinking about race.
You know, as I read, and your chapters on the trial are fascinating because you quote a lot of the transcript from the trial. So you really hear the questions and how they're framed and how they're answered. One of the arguments of the defense attorneys was you couldn't prove that the person who – the body that was pulled out of the river several days after the murder was actually Emmett Till's because it had begun to disintegrate. You know, today that just seems so absurd because DNA, we would have solved that problem quickly. But that was a major piece of their defense, and so the defense – is based on something that today just seems absurd, that, oh, no, that's not Emmett Till.
That's absolutely true. DNA would have certainly solved that problem, although it's not as if in small towns, sheriff's offices had access to any kind of good forensic material. There was never an attempt to recover the bullet and link it to a gun, for example, any of that sort of thing. Still, the evidence was pretty good. His mother had testified that, yes, this was Emmett. She examined the body. This was my son. As one of the prosecuting attorneys said, no mother wants to admit that she has seen her son's dead body. He had a ring on his finger. The body was naked except for a ring. It was his father's ring with the initials L.T. Lewis Till. There was an eyewitness who saw the murderers with Till just hours before he was murdered, and also saw Till taken into a barn and heard screams from a beating. So the evidence was pretty good, but the defense attorney's strategy, all five of the attorneys in the tiny town of Sumner came to the defense of the two defendants. The defense strategy was simple. One, the implication that this was an assault, a would-be rape. And two, even then, that was not Emmett Till in the river. You couldn't identify the body. The sheriff of the town, the sheriff of Tallahatchie County, basically attested to that. I couldn't tell who it was. That body's probably been in the river 10 days. Couldn't just be 3 days. So that the strategy was to instill a reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. Here was a reasonable doubt. That's not Emmett Till.
And it didn't take the jury long to come to a conclusion.
Just over an hour, and they said it would have taken less if they hadn't stopped to have a Coke.
Right. They had to ask for a Coke. One of the interesting things, the trial was a national, actually international phenomenon. A lot of African-American reporters covered this trial, and you explore that. This case was an example of the limits of objective journalism, that it wasn't enough just to report what people were saying. What do you mean by that?
Well, certainly the dozen or so African-American journalists who came from the Chicago Defender, the St. Louis Argus, the Baltimore Afro-American, all of the African-American newspapers – there were real limits, given the position of the sheriff of Tallahatchie County, there were real limits to what kind of research could be done to find evidence. And one of the things that happened was that the reporters themselves, by the third day of the trial, became involved in searching for witnesses. They were instrumental in bringing in the young man, Willie Reed, who described seeing the defendants with Till just before the moment he was murdered. So there really was a necessity of their being involved in the trial itself. And this was true in other ways. I should say also that just to try to set the scene a little bit, you have to remember this is an all-white jury, all-male jury. African Americans are almost two-thirds of the population of Tallahatchie County, but not a single one could vote. And since not a single one could vote, not a single one—
In the entire county.
In the entire county. Not a single one could serve on a jury. And juries, felony juries of this kind were for men only, no women.
Well, and also, it was very unusual that African Americans were testifying against white defendants.
There's a moment in the trial, and let me just say that those black journalists were segregated off in a table in the far, far corner by themselves. That's where Mamie Till Bradley, Emmett Till's mother, also sat during the trial. But there's a moment where Emmett Till's uncle is on the witness stand describing when his nephew was kidnapped, and he is asked if he sees the defendants in the courtroom. Do you see Roy Bryant? And he stands. He's a small man, 5'3", but he stands and he points at Roy Bryant. There he is, he says. He points at J.W. Milam. There he is, he says. And Murray Kempton, a really great journalist from that era, wrote for the New York Post, wrote, that had to be his testimony, that era, that period of his testimony, had to be the hardest half hour in the hardest life possible in America.
You know, today we are fixated on the divisions in American life, American politics, American culture. But as I read your book, I mean, the Emmett Till murder and the Emmett Till trial, you know, reveal America as incredibly divided, filled with conspiracy theories, everybody adopting conspiracy theories on various sides. And it sounds frighteningly familiar to what we're experiencing on some levels.
I almost want to respond to that by simply saying, yes, it's true. It's, the divisions were terribly, terribly deep, North and South, but even certainly within the North and to a certain extent within the South. And yes, conspiracy theories of again, that the prosecutor, the defense attorneys say that the NAACP came down to Mississippi and planted a body to substitute that and said it was Emmett Till. Well, that's you know, that's crazy, and yet that was the sort of theory that was propagated. Yes, you see the divisions very, very clearly, and even in how we remember Emmett Till today, some of our own divisions today show up in how we talk about the Emmett Till murder.
You know, one thing I would say about today is we have a person at the top of the federal government who, President Trump, who might stir this up. In the case of President Eisenhower, federal government's just absent from all of this. They are not playing a role, period. I mean, not intervening in any creative way.
The federal government is just as active as they can be in trying to stay inactive. In just the FBI, the Justice Department, just doing their best to stay away from this case.
Well, Elliot Gorin, we have just scratched the surface of what you've revealed and let the people see. Wonderful book. Great to have you back in Cincinnati. And thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Jim Wallis, the founder of Sojourners, has been an evangelical prophetic voice in American life for four decades. After the break, he joins Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.